So I've always loved letters. They're these bubble letters. If you imagine a balloon with overlapping edges, I was working the alphabet out when I was in grade school. And I don't even know where I first saw those letters, but I know that I just needed to figure out how to do an alphabet in bubble letters. And so when graffiti started to, the modern graffiti movement started to happen in LA in the mid 80s, I just thought, that's really interesting. And I wasn't thinking about documenting it. I just appreciated it, but I wasn't looking for something to document.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the mind shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we're diving into the vibrant and often misunderstood world of urban art with none other than Steve Grody, a renowned chronicler of Los Angeles, also a martial arts master and an influential figure in the swing dance community. Steve began with a passion for pop art graphics and psychedelic art, leading him to a Bachelor of Arts in Fine Arts from Cal State Northridge. However, the emergence of spray can murals across Los Angeles captured his imagination and sent him on a path of exploration and documentation. Since 1990, Steve has traversed the hidden corners of LA, gaining the trust of the city's most prolific graphic artist. His work has led to the creation of an extensive archive of urban art form and the publication of his book, Graffiti LA, Street Styles and Art, which is a seminal work in the field. His expertise and contributions to understanding graffiti has been recognized in prestigious venues such as the MoCA Art in the Streets exhibition show. In addition to his work in the graffiti world, Steve has dedicated decades to studying and teaching martial arts under the tutelage of legends and is now a revered instructor. His passion for swing dance, sparked by classic cinema, has seen him evolve from an enthusiastic student to a respected teacher. So join us as we explore Steve Grody's multifaceted life, delving into his profound impact on the graffiti community, his martial arts journey, and his love for swing dance. Let's discover the stories behind his legendary status and gain insights into the creativity and dedication required to master such diverse and dynamic fields. Steve, welcome to Innovation Insights.
Lovely to be here with you, Yolanda. Thank you. The thing, it's lovely to be here. I was thinking about what we were going to talk about today and the relationship that all these fields have. And they all, the one thing that you didn't mention, there's no reason why you would have, unless I had told you about it, is my involvement with music. I've been playing chromatic harmonica since the early 60s and just playing along with everybody from John Coltrane to Jimi Hendrix to whoever. Whatever instrumentalist, I'm very influenced by Otis Rush from the Chicago blues sound and things like that, but with a more extended vocabulary. But what they all have in common is everything, the overriding theme is expressive flow. And so with the graffiti project, it just, the expression is obvious. The term flow is central in hip hop. And it's interesting because different disciplines express the same concept in different way. In jazz, we talk about phrasing. In art, we talk about composition and balance and weight and balance and visual flow. And in swing dance, again, there's flow, there's phrasing. And they all share that. And that's what sparks me, those different ways that human beings express themselves.
Ah. That is great. And you've made such a nice connection between all of these areas, from music to dance to graffiti. Why don't we go back? How did you start? You started off as a fine arts student. And what what initiated that for you?
Well, I've always been interested in different forms of art. So as a kid, I loved the kind of virtuoso drawing of Wallace Wood and Bill Elder that drew for Mad, these little books for Mad magazine, just sparked me. And I have early drawings. I called it Eye Land because it was taking from somehow, I think, hot rod culture, flaming eyeballs. And here's one with an artist beret, and here's one with a doctor's stethoscope, and here's one with a railroad engineer. And so that always something I was interested in. And then my youth era of art was the psychedelic era. The psychedelic era also blended over into the late 1800s because the psychedelic poster artists were all influenced by the French poster artist Mouchard and the English with Beardsley. And that sparked me. But then I was always just interested in art in general. And so my degree is in painting, drawing, and photography. But in photography, it was not a documentary. It wasn't a documentary orientation. I was composing in the lens, fine arts photography, so-called, rather than, social photography. But in the mid, so I've always loved letters. There are these bubble letters. If you imagine a balloon with overlapping edges, I was working the alphabet out when I was in grade school. And I don't even know where I first saw those letters, but I know that I just needed to figure out how to do an alphabet in bubble letters. And so when the modern graffiti movement started to happen in LA in the mid 80s, I just thought that's really interesting. And I wasn't thinking about documenting it. I just appreciated it, but I wasn't looking for something to document. And then in 1990, I passed Belmont Tunnel, which is this big open area where once upon a time LA had a subway that came out of from Elysian Pershing Square and then came out of a tunnel and went up north on Glendale Boulevard. And it was this big open area. And then when the subway and that train system shut down, it was just left this big open area, which in 1984, as the graffiti movement was starting to get going, kids started to paint on these walls. And at first, the cops would stop them because they thought it must be gang-related. And then when they realized that it was a different thing and that it wasn't gang activity, they just thought, okay. Most of the times, they would just say, go ahead, paint. This is not vandalism. There's no business that it wants information on these walls. Go ahead and paint. And so for 20 years, that was a world-renowned site for graffiti writers in Los Angeles and around the world to show what they could do. And I came down the hill in summer of 1990, just after this battle, and that's a whole thing. A battle in graffiti is one person going up on a wall next to another person or a crew next to another crew to see in the graffiti community's eyes who's better. And it was a real step up out of gang life, where a battle was a life and death thing, or still is in various areas. But in graffiti life, even though it's not, in graffiti culture, there are fights, but nobody's shooting at each other. It's rare that the violence goes beyond a fat lip, a black eye. And so I just thought, wow, this is too much. It just needs to be a record of this. And I wasn't thinking about a publication project. I was just thinking that it was a shame that something with so much verve would just disappear without a record. And so I started to document it. And then I finally, at this one place, and then I ran into somebody who was repairing somebody else's piece, a piece short for masterpiece or an individual's piece. And when they decided that I didn't have a cop vibe, they told me about another place, and then those people got used to seeing me around and nobody was getting arrested. And after a while, just people would tell me about places I would go to some place new. And if somebody would say, who are you and how do you know about this place? If I told them Skate told me about this place or Dello told me about this place, they know I had to be for real because they could get in touch with that person and know you can't make names up. You got to, because they can check it out. And so it's, and this one thing led to another and just got very obsessive because the stuff comes and goes and you got to get it while it's hot.
Well, yeah. So thank goodness that, you know, you were capturing this because as you says, it changes and comes and goes. And talk to me a little bit more about how people that you met, because it is a tight-knit community, obviously. You were able to gain credibility by confirming that there's such one.
Yeah, there's an old saying probably in many scenes, but the first thing is you just got to show up. You just got to make an effort and show up. And so at first, years later, people would tell me that there was discussion about me in the community. It's like, who's that guy? He's old enough to be our parents, which meant I was in my 30s. who's this guy? And there were people that were saying there's only two possibilities. He's crazy or he's a cop. And then after a while, some people would talk to me enough to realize I wasn't a cop and not crazy enough to be dangerous. And they would start to talk to me. And then I would be someplace and one guy would see me coming down taking pictures and he would drop his spray can and walk away until he ran into another graffiti writer. And he'd point to me and go, "Who the heck is that?" And the guy said, "Oh, that's Steve. He's cool. It's okay." There was a certain point of pride in graffiti. One of the things that's so interesting, there are very few people that would immediately relate modern graffiti movement to Zen practice. But the fact is, there's a great relationship to Zen practice, even if they don't see it that way. And the reason is because they're going to a wall, maybe legal, maybe illegal, but they're going to do the best thing they can with the time they have before they either feel they're done or they got to leave because they're being chased away by their gangsters or cop. They're going to do the best thing they can. And they know it's going to be gone. It's going to disappear in somewhere between a day and a month or a few months, depending upon how difficult the spot is to get to. They're still going to do their best. They're not doing it to, none of them originally were doing it for an art career because there was no such thing. There was no concept as doing as in the early days of as an art career, as a graffiti, for being a professional graffiti artist was just some kind of crazy dream. And so it couldn't be commodified. It couldn't be bought. It couldn't be sold. There was no interweb at the time. So if for people that wanted to see it and appreciate it, they had to make a real effort to get on their bike or their skateboard or the bus and go to places where it might have been not the most welcoming environment. And so it meant a lot to the participants just to even see it. And it meant a lot to the people to do it because there's risk, physical and legal, to do it. So it's a very charged activity. You don't do it casually. But you're letting it go. You do the best thing you can, and you're not precious about it because you know somebody's going to go over you or somehow it's going to get gone. And that, to me, is there's something beautiful about that. And to any of your listeners that are harumphing, well, the vandalism and the fourth thing, yes, I would like to remind people that in all human activity, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. Even in religious organizations, there's scandals. In political organizations, there's corruption and scandals. In all human activity, there are people that have integrity and there are people that are just scamming and hustling. And so the same thing in graffiti culture, the general rules of the game, which were not always held to, the rules of the game were public space, not private property, like up somebody's home. Generally, that's more of a gang thing rather than a modern graffiti thing. And that's a big difference between gang culture and modern graffiti culture. They say you don't hit a car. You don't ever hit a religious institution. Don't go over anything you can't burn. In other words, don't, if there's some a piece on a wall, don't go over it unless you really think you can do better than that. And if you do go over it, cover the whole thing out of respect rather than leaving bits of it hanging out. And those were some of the rules of the game, but it's a rebellious culture and there are a lot of kids that don't necessarily adhere to that. And oh, and most graffiti writers, 70% of graffiti writers would not ever go over or say a mural that's by a freeway. So, because in Los Angeles, there are murals by the freeways and they've gotten really hit quite a bit, but the majority of graffiti writers don't approve of that. They feel that you should respect all art. But unfortunately, there's a very active minority that makes the public think that all graffiti writers are knuckleheads. It's an interesting culture. It's a subculture with its own rules of behavior and all of its internecine political hoo-ha.
How interesting. And thanks for laying out the norms and the rules within the subculture.
It's interesting because we're talking names, and I've shot probably several thousand trains rolling through Iowa that are really good. I'll sit at the tracks and I'll practice. I'll work on my music until a train comes by. Then I'll jump out with my camera. There are at least 500, 600 trains I've shot with people on them from LA. If people look carefully, they'll notice that most of the people that write on trains and do graffiti, because graffiti, they don't call themselves graffiti artists, call themselves writers. Their graffiti art is something you do in a gallery. Graffiti is something you do out in the world, legal or illegal. And they, so since the basis of graffiti is writing your name, they call themselves writers traditionally. So the people that are writing on trains, painting trains, you notice the ones that are really elaborate generally avoid going over any of the ID numbers of a train. You notice that all the ID information is still there. And that's because of two reasons. Number one, because if they go over those numbers, the train company will come, the train line will come back with a big stamp and stamp the numbers on there and cover, obscure a lot of the piece. But some of them actually are thinking, you know what, just because we're doing something illegal doesn't mean we have to be a knucklehead and make the business of the trains more difficult. So that's a thing people may notice. Most people, when they get to the railroad tracks, if they're getting the railroad tracks and their barrier's coming down, they go, oh, darn it, the train. I'm going, oh boy, a train. who's, let's see if there's anybody on here I know.
That's great.
It's interesting because of the illegality and because there is vandalism. And I understand why people, I'm not telling people that they shouldn't bothered or offended by the actual vandalism, but I would say two things. Number one, distinguish between vandalism and work that's not vandalistic, even though it's illegal. In other words, one of the favorite places for graffiti writers to paint are on the backs of industrial buildings that border railroad tracks. So the people coming to and from those businesses never even see that surface. And so kids painting, nobody operating in the business or with the business has any idea that's even going on. So it's hard for me to see how that's vandalistic, where vandalism really, the intention is to be destructive and be in your face and defacing. But the other thing I would say is because in the same way that it's a developed thing, you learn to have, you, one has to have an develop an educated eye to look at abstract art and art in general, but there's a lot of art that's skillful. So people may not be hip to the nuance of the composition or the color palette or anything, but they can say, oh, that's skillful. And I like that. But the more abstract it gets, the more people need to have a educated eye to dig it. And because a lot of graffiti is relatively abstract, and people don't easily read the letters, they don't look at it at all. But there's still rhythm, flow, and craft. Anytime somebody's stuck at the tracks and looking at a train, they see something go by, they should just be aware that's all done freehand with spray cans, and they get these very sharp lines and these very beautiful color blends and these very intricate interactions and abstractions of the letter forms. It's really amazing. So if people can get past the illegality of it and just chill and enjoy it, they might see it in a different perspective. And may I just say to everybody out there, don't shoot the messenger. I'm just trying to tell you, here's the thing. It's graffiti is in our environment. And since it's in the environment, we might as well understand it a little bit better. It just means that everybody has to love it. Mm-hmm. But we might as well understand it a little bit better. In the same way that if I had a home in the woods, in the mountains, I want to know, okay, that plant I can put in my salad, that plant will give me a rash. That snake is good. That snake will kill you. Okay. This is, you know, just what it is. And we're all urban dwellers. Even in Ames, there's a certain amount of urban stuff here, and might as well understand it better since it's there, for better or for worse. So that's part of the thing. And I always like to, there is some gang stuff that rolls by on trains, but it's probably not more than 10 or 15% of which in a train. So graffiti writers, there are people that think that gangs and graffiti is potato, but it's, I know ex-gang members and some not so ex that don't even call what they call gang writing, and graffiti is the modern stuff. And so there was one guy in a documentary that said he's renowned for his gang style letters and his tattooing. He's long retired. He's thrilled to be retired. He's taken all of that passion, that intensity that it took to survive gang life into an art career and tattoo career. And he's doing tours around the world because his letters are so renowned. And on this documentary, he said, I tried graffiti for a while, but I came back to the placa. That's the placa, placasso. Those are the terms for gang writing styles coming out of Latino tradition. And that influenced the modern graffiti in Los Angeles greatly because there was such attitude in those letters. So that kids around the city, just traveling around the city, they see these letters and they saw the attitude and they didn't want to be in a gang necessarily, or they were in a gang and they wanted to get out of gangs through modern graffiti. So they took the influence of these certain structures of these letters, which had attitude, and that's the basis of LA style. The first people in Los Angeles in the mid 80s that developed an LA style were people that were getting out of gangs, and they got, and one of the things that's why there's somebody who printed up t-shirts saying graffiti saved my life, which would puzzle a lot of people, but there's no shortage of kids that actually found a different passion to be a way to be alive as a kid, to do graffiti. And that was their kind of exit from gang life.
Interesting. And so that also brings me to the question of how do people learn to be either modern graffiti artists or a writer? And then if you could expand upon basically the use of elements and principles of design, because we teach that in education, and what you've explained is that innately or naturally many individuals have that ability.
Yes. It's so interesting because whether somebody uses terms in art like formalism, it is. One renowned writer goes by the name of Atlas. He would say, you look at this piece and you would squint to see what area was needed more complexity, or was the density, the visual density in different areas, and whether there was visual balance. That's what fine artists do all the time. They squint at the canvas and they read it a different way. And they all talk about flow. They talk about connection. They talk about rhythm. And they talk, so it's principles of design and flow and color palette. It's just, but they have their own distinct vocabulary, and it's their own tradition, very developed technical vocabulary of what's what. But then what's interesting, as in any tradition, it can become a straitjacket. It can become bounded. And there are those that are saying, okay, folks, you've got skills, but let's push the envelope here. It's a little bit too classic rock for me. Let's see something we haven't seen before. And it's interesting. I've talked about this with veteran graffiti writers. They're like, yeah, there's a lot of too much the same. Skillfully done, but too much the same. And there have been times over the recent years where I'm going by down an alleyway and I'm seeing a lot of work and I'm thinking, you know what? 3 years ago, I would have been taking pictures of this, but now I don't want to even spend 8 megabytes on it in a small image. It's just enough. Or this person, I have enough representation of this person. I don't need another one of this same thing.
So that really makes me think about innovation, because there seems to be a desire for continued innovation within the art form too, which I'm sure people don't think about that with graffiti.
Yeah, the innovation can take place in various different ways. It can take place formally in terms of, in other words, the kind of work that they're doing, the way they're using their borders or the way they're shaping or creating the letters. It could be in terms of their innovation, in terms of where they're getting up. Where, that's interesting. I never thought of trying to get those kinds of spots before. And it could also be that some people could look up the MSK map tour that on Instagram, and there are people that decide that as a crew or as a shifting roster of people from a crew, they're going to go across the country and just find different spots to do their thing and leave their little, hello, I was here. Again, there's some people that would rather see a blank concrete wall than something by Rhyme, who spells his name R-I-M-E. But Rhyme does stuff with rhythm and flow and humor and whimsy, and I would rather see that than just bare concrete under a bridge. So there are different ways, and some people one of the ways was the exchange, where to push the envelope of their skills, a select group of writers would take a sketch by a different artist and do their name, but it was done in the style by another artist. They would execute somebody else's sketch in there. They would execute the sketch, somebody else's style of their name. And just, it was just a way to say, let's find a way to change it up and keep ourselves interested. Or for example, there was one group of writers. They thought, okay, what can we do that would be fun? And they all did their names as though they were rock formations in nature, just as a way of saying, what do we do? Our name was like a rock formation. So they do try to change it up. And some people are just proudly, I'm just going to do the same thing I've done 10,000 times. And I think, okay, that's cool. But anyway, so it's interesting.
It's like with the rest of the world and life. Sometimes, I'll just do it the same way and keep doing the same thing the same way. If a new artist comes along, how do they start out? Is there like an apprenticeship program?
Yes.
Or do you follow someone?
In essence, yes. It's so interesting because, again, for all of the indignation about modern graffiti in general, it is a classic old school endeavor. First of all, the whole thing, learning how to sketch and learning how to design, eye-hand coordination, analog skills. You start by yourself, but then somewhere along the line, you need mentors. And you run into people, because if you're a dedicated writer, you learn where it is and you show up. Again, show up. And if you have a good attitude, back in the early day, which for LA, in New York, that was the early 70s. In LA, that was the mid-80s when it started to happen. And you would be a kid, you'd show up somewhere. If it seemed like you had a good attitude, they would let you buff the wall. In other words, do background on the wall with paint rollers, and you still have an attitude, you still have a decent attitude, maybe they'll let you fill in a little spot. And after a while, they'd say, let me see your sketches. Okay, well, you're not ready. Those letters are whack. You need to get better letters before we let you go up in a wall with, not with us anyway. okay, now we're going to see what you can do. And you're going to see if you can take advice. See if you can take advice. Let's see. See about this terrible, rebellious culture. Respect your elders, mentorship, patience, skills developed over time, commitment, taking risk. Gee whiz.
Sounds like an education program or a training program or, yeah, a corporate training program.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that over the years, it's been interesting for me to see where there's been attrition. Some people just get somewhere and then they just fade into normal life. And that, that's nothing against them. And some people keep doing graffiti, but they have other careers. I know studio electricians and gaffers. I know a number of professional backdrop painters for movie sets. And the thing that thrilled me is that there are these two of the seminal early books that came out in 84 and 86 were Subway Art by Henry Chalfont and Martha Cooper. And then in 86, Subway Art by Jim Prigoff and Henry Chalfont again, documenting. And that was what got millions of kids around the world. Oh my God, that was their Bible. That's the way it was described. That was the thing that I would just study those pages forever. And there was a point here. There was this apprenticeship that took place. So very old school.
How fascinating.
But the thing is, what I was going to say is that, and some people have a regular job, and then when they do, they still do graffiti when they can. And I know people that are in their 50s and maybe getting close to their 60s from LA that are still out there. And then some, a select few, actually have art careers, either as graphic designers, professional muralists by commission, or gallery art careers. Revoke, just some months ago, had a one-man show at the Detroit Museum of Art. And his work is, you would not, unless you knew who he was, you wouldn't know that his work necessarily had anything to do with graffiti or graffiti background. It's very formally conceived and relating to the contemporary art traditions now. But, and then there are others that you can see their graffiti is part of their contemporary art practice. Some, it's just more formalist and you'd say it would have to be pointed out where their graffiti influence is. There's this one artist that goes by the name of Fish, F-I-S-H-E, and his work, he uses a lot of geometric patterns and torn edges of things, along with this palimpsest of graffiti in the background that really works together beautifully. And so that's why it was those people. I co-curated a show in 2011 called Street Cred, Graffiti Art from Concrete to Canvas. And it was about those artists in LA that had evolved a separate body of work for the gallery or museum setting. And so some of it, you could see the graffiti influence, and some of it was just like, oh, that's really interesting abstract art. They wouldn't know it. Like Juan Carlos Munoz Hernandez, or as he calls it, who goes by Heaven. And sometimes you say his whole name and he just goes, yeah, I'm Juan Carlos, blah, blah, blah. His work looks very formalist, but everything has meaning to him because these blocky forms have to do as a reflection of growing up on a block where you had to know somebody on every block to be able to pass without a problem. You would use the corners of blocks for protection. You put corners of blocks on your piece for a visual protection. All of these elements that somebody might just see it as nice abstract pattern, but for him, it's totally charged and meaningful. So yes. It's interesting.
The meanings of those symbols.
Yeah.
So, in your career, how have people approached you or felt about you studying graffiti artists? What feedback do you get from people?
I've tried to keep this little file of people out of the blue writing to me saying, well, you're part of the history and you're in the mix and you've been respectful. You didn't clown us. When my book came out, there were a number of people supposedly writing books, and I'm the one that came out with one. There's one other book that came out that was done by graffiti writers, and that one gets a lot more complaints than my book. because there's so many misattributions and misspelling them, just missed. It was just amateur hour. In any event, they felt that I represented them respectfully, that I didn't caricature them. They recognized themselves in my book because I used their voices. I was worried that I had to try and be the dry, sober narrator. And I was worried that the book would be dry. Oh my goodness, their voices are so juicy and so expressive. I didn't have, when I started to interview them, I thought, oh, I don't have to worry about a thing because they're carrying this thing. And I tried to make sure that I had a balanced view. The term in hip hop is jock, jocking somebody. That means riding too closely. I made sure I didn't just jock one crew. I didn't just represent West Side Riders or East Side Riders. I tried to speak with Northeast, South, East Side, and really have a balanced view. And so I get a lot of love for that book to this day. Although there are always people that will, just to feel superior, demean anybody that's one of their crew or an outsider. So one guy was like, you haven't run from the cops with the wind in your hair. And man, I'm like, dude, first of all, I don't have a lot of hair to have wind in. So let's just pass on that one. And so what? I've taken my risks. I've gone. There was one in when my book was released in 2007. And I did this panel in New York with some veteran graffiti writers. And I was about to end the panel. And this one veteran graffiti writer said, wait, I want to say something here. When I first met Steve, and I thought, okay, we'll see. And I saw this guy is going to these dodgy environments where generally graffiti writers would not go by themselves. They wouldn't go without crew, without back. And I was going there by myself. And he said, I thought to myself, this guy is going to end up without his camera or his wallet or his pants. But you kept going. And there's so many writers that, again, it was a point of pride to let go. And so there were a lot of graffiti writers that, first of all, they were kids. They didn't have money for film. And also was a point of pride to just do it and let go. And so many of them were so glad that I was documenting stuff because they're like, oh my goodness, I don't even remember doing that piece, but I'm so glad you have that. You're bringing back memories. And so there will always be people with a little bit of attitude because you're not their crew, but I feel really fortunate and proud to have a lot of veterans that consider me a friend and I consider a friend, and I've gotten props from people. It was funny because on my nephew, my younger nephew has I took him on a graffiti tour and he chopped them up into pieces. They're on Mandy Patinkin's TikTok site and some on his Facebook page. My nephew wanted to know what's what. And so I was explaining different issues to him. And some people would write in saying, who is this person explaining things for the Chicano community? Who is this outsider? First of all, it's embarrassing because to say it's a Chicano art form, because it's a rainbow coalition. Hip hop is a rainbow art form. Everybody from every economic background and ethnicity is involved. Although it has started and the core of it is from people coming out more out of the streets, but of all colors and ethnicities, kids from street life, that's where it comes from. But I'm considered part of that community. I'm not considered outside of that community. And so on occasion, I explained something to somebody that was defending people that don't need defending. The things that I'm saying about graffiti, I've learned from graffiti writers telling me. I'm not some professorial jerk saying, clearly this is a protest against late-stage neo-capitalism, even if they don't know it is. Whoa. Because sometimes you get that with academics interpreting street culture, and it's really embarrassing that they feel the need to put it through a contemporary political filter that none of the participants relate to. So it's interesting. There was one panel where somebody asked me, what about Fluxus, the Fluxus movement, art movement that had to do with street art interventions and certain things. And I said, the Fluxus art movement was an attempt to have a kind of a Marxist-based dialectic with the art world. And so the Fluxus movement is like a yappy little dog yapping at the art world, whereas graffiti culture is like a cat just ignoring it. Just whatever. And graffiti artists will look at the art world to some degree and they'll take certain inspirations from it, but they're outside of the institution. And that's one of the reasons why the institution has taken so long to recognize graffiti. But at a certain point, institutions, big museums, want to feel like they're with it and cool. And oh, 23 Skidoo, oh, you kid, we're with it. And so they'll bring in shows that have to do with graffiti and street art, even if they're generally very uneven. And they tend to do shows that are the kind of graffiti in a museum that looks like graffiti in a museum rather than something that's more interesting and evolved, the more interesting and evolved stuff that doesn't necessarily look like graffiti.
Uh-huh. It is interesting, the attitude of the cat that you think. That's very confident. Okay, I'm doing this art form and accept it or not, I'm doing my thing.
And yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because the Taoist term, Zuren, T-Z, is usually transliterated T-Z-U-R-E-N. It's generally translated spontaneity, but it's difficult to translate because the more literal translation is like self, one scholar, but it's like that there, any graffiti writer will say that any of the best graffiti writers are all saying, you're trying to express your own personality through those letters. That everybody's personality comes through in those letters, all the top people. And not only do their personalities come through in those letters, but the day they did that piece on that wall, how am I feeling today? Am I feeling angrier? Am I feeling happier? Am I feeling more bubbly? Am I feeling more anxious? That needs to show in those letters. And I find that practice really interesting, that they're looking for a certain kind of authenticity and self-expression.
I was just thinking that being authentic, and that's something that we talk quite a bit about on this podcast, being authentic within your storytelling. And so that's great.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are always people that feel more comfort by doing what's done before because it's been accepted. And then there are people that are they're wanderers. They're like, what's around the corner creatively? What can I do? How can I keep myself excited in what I'm doing? And I'm not just being one of the gang, but I'm pushing the envelope. There are people that's what they're posting. They're saying, okay, here are people that I see doing something interesting in modern graffiti that, you know, and they're encouraging. They're just saying, come on, folks, let's put a little effort here. It's like bebop. Bebop was such an innovation. But if somebody is just copying Still Charlie Parker, first of all, that would be quite an achievement in and of itself. But still, you want to hear, okay, great. That's amazing that you've memorized all of these solos by Charlie Parker, but I want to hear what you can do with it now. Yeah, so it's the same thing with swing dance. There are people that they're very big on doing things that have been done, and they're not very playful. And I never really thought, just was playful, but I wasn't thinking that it was unusual. But there were these dance instructors that would come over to here to do seminars from Sweden and England. And I was dancing. And when I was starting to dance with them, there's this one, Julie Oram, a terrific swing dancer and a professional performer. She was dragging other friends over from England. Hey, dance with Steve. He's doing stuff different. And he wasn't like, boy, this is awful. You really got to dance. She liked it because I wasn't like doing four moves to the left and those four moves to the right. I was trying to listen to the music, play with the music, feel who my partner was, and create some kind of dialogue. And I didn't really think, I thought, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? And apparently she found that to be unusual because there were a lot of people that were just throwing, they were very skillful, but they were just throwing moves at you. Look what I can do. Yeah, okay. But can you flow? Can you interact with me? Can you acknowledge my personality here, my dance personality?
Yeah, understanding the human that you're dancing with. Right. So how did you get involved with dance? Was that something that was part of your whole life too, or?
No, it was part of, as a child, I'm old enough that there was no cable TV or anything. There was late night TV. And late night TV meant they played the classic black and white silver screen movies and comedies and screwball comedies that are now like would be in a revival circuit. But that's what they played at night. And I know that somewhere along the line, I saw Whitey's Lindy Hoppers doing those amazing Lindy Hop scenes in the Marx Brothers movies, A Night at the Opera and A Day at the Races. And I never would have thought that about approximately 1,000 years later that I would actually end up studying with Frankie Manning. And it was my swing dance teacher, Aaron Stevens, who brought him out of retirement. Because when bebop killed swing, he retired and he just thought, okay, I'm getting a job at the post office and I had a great run and that's it. And then all of a sudden, here's this teenage girl and her partner coming from Los Angeles and trying to drag him out of retirement saying, you should, Lindy Hop and Lindy, you know, show me how you did it. And he didn't want to, he was like, no, this, it's over, it's done. And finally took pity on them and they showed him what they were trying to put together. He said, okay, I'll help you out. Ended up being this huge life for him, traveling around the world to adoring thousands of people at swing dance camps in the 90s and 2000s to teach them. But he just had so much life to him. And so I saw those movies when I was a kid and it just stuck in the back of my mind. And in the late 80s, I started, if I was seeing some woman, I'd say, have you ever thought of doing that? I don't know what you call it, jitterbug stuff. And finally found somebody that was knew where they were teaching it. And I started in 1993 and started to get involved. I just like, oh yeah, I got to get this down. I got to learn this. This is just, it's a way of moving with joy. It's all about moving with joy and play. And how do you play with another person in such a kind of relatively intimate way that's not potentially threatening? You go, I've never been a bar person, but I imagine somebody going to a bar and sitting down next to some guy sitting down next to some woman trying to strike up a conversation. She's thinking, okay, so let's see how long this bozo lasts. Let's see what this guy wants. And okay, I've got to go take a call. But a swing dance, well, you're dancing with somebody for 5 minutes or 8 minutes, depending upon band or not. And it's a risk that people are more willing to take. And it's, you know, everybody, you know, somebody's personality right away without saying a word, just by the way they're interacting with you. Are they open? Are they playful? Are they nervous? Are they relaxed? They having fun with you? And it's a weird chemistry because some people you just have a rapport with and other people you just don't. And you can't say, oh, that's because they do Carolina Shag and I was doing Savoy Lindy Hop. No, they're doing Savoy Lindy Hop and I'm doing Savoy Lindy Hop, but just the rapport is off or it's on and you can't say why. It's just a thing. It's so interesting.
Oh, and how have you translated that to younger generations? Because I know you teach. And how do younger generations capture that joy? And
for one thing, in the swing during the 90s, during the big swing revival, kids just thought, oh my, wow, this is it. This is it. And sadly for some of them, they were too young to understand that things come and things go. There are still places to swing dance, but it's not like you had three choices of where to swing dance 7 nights a week like you did during the mid-90s. And they were freaked out when swing, the fad of it, started to close down. And in any event, the main thing is what I tell people when I'm teaching, at Iowa State, I just say, look, any music that makes you want to do this, that makes you want to move your body, bob your head, that's swing dance music. By definition, if you want to do this, then you can move the whole rest of your body. So when I teach, I try to make sure I bring in music that's not just swing dance or blues and rhythm and blues from the 40s, 50s, 40s and 50s and 60s. I try and say, look, this is contemporary rhythm and blues. This is contemporary instrumental stuff. It's got a pulse and you can dance to it. You don't, and I just try and say, look, there's nothing wrong with just shaking your booty and just moving around. Nothing wrong with that. But to actually interact with somebody and create a dialogue with the music, that's like dance to the third power, because it's just, you're so much in more, you're relating to a person while relating to the music, while feeling how you want to move. I just think it's, and I'm very precise about the vocabulary, not that the way, the grammar, how you signal and receive the signals and give a signal so that you seamlessly and comfortably can interact. But I make it clear that the reason for being clear in your lead and precise in your follow is just so you can have fun. It's not because those are the rules, and somebody said those are rules. It's just to be able so that you can play. And there's a certain, one of the reasons, the other reason that swing dance stayed dead for a while during the 60s and 70s is because it was a time of political, cultural kind of liberation for people. And the thought in feminism was, oh, you're going to lead me? I beg your pardon. We can both dance together as equals, but don't tell me how to move. Here's the thing. First of all, there are a lot of women that like to learn to lead, and that's fine. There are men that will dance with, can dance with, like in tango, a male dancing with a male. It's not a sexual thing. It's just people that speak the same language can do that thing and explore different moves. And it's the same thing in this kind of contemporary swing dance culture. But also, it's what I would want to say to somebody that felt that it was a domineering thing for somebody to lead is, first of all, the more expert somebody can speak swing language, as it were, the more you can loosen up the dialogue in terms of who's responding and who's leading. There's more and more input from the so-called follow, the more advanced you get. That's number one. Number two, I would want to say to somebody, tell you what, would it be okay if I told you a story and you can interject at any point and you can ask questions about the story, or you can see if the story can go in a different direction? Because that's what we're doing with the dance. I'm taking you on, telling you a story. I'm sharing that story with you and you get to interact with me, but I'm not, you don't have to shut up for the whole story. You get to talk to me while I'm talking to you, and take, and do this gets to be a shared dialogue. That's the way I see it.
I think that's a good example that could be used for a leadership model too, is that you have a leader, but there's input and shared.
An important word in any kind of human interaction is trust. And one of the things that trust means is that you can speak openly and honestly. The graffiti community, bring it back to that for a moment, it's amazing how unprecious they are about talking to each other. Hey, dude, I'm having trouble with this letter connection. Oh, well, man, that's because top of the letter is too thick and the bottom's too thin, and you got to bring that connection around the back of it. That colonial blue you're using, just you lose that connection. So you got to use some more icy grape on there. Oh, yeah, okay. So nobody's getting bent out of shape. They're soliciting input from other artists. It's the kind of honesty that any other creative people involved in some kind of collaborative creative pursuit would want. Yes. So trust in interactions in any kind of relationship and open dialogue is really crucial. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And we've talked, this has been an interesting conversation because we talked about that within graffiti and within dance. And again, many of the elements that you brought up, again, great for leadership, professional development, for business practices, educational practices. How does all of this also move into your martial arts background?
Before we talk about the martial arts, I think what I'm sure you've experienced is that when there's a certain kind of creative open dialogue, an idea comes out of somewhere. And somebody might say, oh, whose idea was that? And you go, I don't know. It was us. It came out of our back and forth. And it just suddenly, we realized we had an idea. And we took it somewhere. I have a patent on a locking device for the interior of camper shells that I need to get back out there and see if I can either sell the patent or get it manufactured in any of it. But my friend, I had an idea and I started to work with this friend of mine because I thought he was a good friend to work with. And we figured out how to do it. And it really is impossible to say really who had the idea for the final iteration because it was from the back and forth. And in terms of martial arts, it's the same thing. There are people that are very big on proud about this tradition is 600 years old and I haven't changed a thing from my ancestors. Okay. There's something cool about feeling that you're part of this long tradition. I understand that. My first teacher was raised in a Taoist temple in the mountains in mainland China before the revolution. So we're talking old school. And I learned a lot of internal work, so-called breathing exercises and healing work along with the martial arts that I learned from him. And I appreciate that. But then I also worked with, for 13 years, with Dan Inosano, who was Bruce Lee's primary student or one of his top students and inheritors. And Bruce Lee's whole thing was innovation, was saying the four rules for Bruce Lee of the process was research your experience, absorb what is useful, reject what is useless, add what is specifically your own. And his whole thing was martial arts is meaningless outside of it being a tool for self-expression. And wait a minute, punching somebody in the nose is expressing yourself? No, it's about the process. You have to use your intellect for certain analysis of an interaction or what works or what doesn't work. There's a certain emotional control of dealing with fear. There's a certain cognitive fluidity that you can't do this without cognitive fluidity because memorizing sequences is not the way anybody has a dialogue. Dialogue is not, Yolanda, I notice you just used sentence 3,425, to which I will respond with sentence 823B. We're just talking. And martial arts interactions need to flow, and there's a process by which you can acquire that flow, and it's not through memorization. It's through learning how to make progressively more choices and progressively a more dense amount of choices at a given moment. But that's a subtle process. And unfortunately, it's easier to teach a big group the same form. We'll do this form all together and feel like we're doing something. But to actually teach how to flow and interact, it's a very different thing. And so I feel that my biggest contributions in terms of martial arts are the process. There's a little bit of stuff structurally, technically, that I think I've come up with that I like, but it's mainly the training process that I feel where I feel I've been innovative. Do I get extra points for using the word innovative?
Yes, you do. Okay. We might have to add like a point meter to that. To the show. Would you expand upon the processes that, if you can, that have included that you feel have been innovative within your martial artwork?
The thing is, everybody moves differently. Everybody has a different physical and brain personality. And so it's important to respect that and work with that person. I think that's an important thing. And you can do that one-to-one. It's very hard to do that with a group situation. It's just like with swing dance. No matter how well you explain it, you need to feel it. But once I'm moving with you, it's amazing how quickly somebody can pick it up if you're moving with them because you're talking to their body. You're not talking to their analytical brain. It's the same thing with martial arts. You got to learn to feel this person, train with this person, move with this person. So it's interesting. You have to be concerned with what is your goal? Is your goal to have a bunch of schools and a chain of schools and to make a lot of money and to have a big reputation? Or is your goal to actually teach somebody something that's alive and alive for them? And I don't know how to do a big chain thing. I have Marshall. I have instructional material that's available, streaming and videos and DVDs, but it really, but even in those cases, I show people how to train with each other to develop skills, because it's not about pattern number one, pattern number two. That's not it. I think that's a central thing.
That's very interesting. So it's very bespoke or individualized.
Yes.
That human, what they're bringing to that.
And it's interesting because I think that in teaching, I think that in innovation, it's like, again, the innovation, somebody's emphasis can be in terms of a business practice, or it can be in terms of the thing that somebody is innovating, whether it's fashion, whether it's music, but the creative product is one thing. And then the creativity and marketing is a separate kind of creativity. Marketing is still pretty much a puzzlement to me. And part of it's because I'm not willing to engage with the puffery. Great chartreuse / great Grandmaster Grody has told you that with these three moves, you can defeat a horde of Mongols with a flick of your wrist. It's just because that's just not the real world. Idols, but I like to be called Steve, and they're called whoever they are. And can we all just respect each other anyway? But innovation, it's interesting because innovation. Yeah, I'm going to use the jazz analogy here. Jazz, to be a jazz musician, you have to do a lot of woodshedding. You have to a lot of practice. You really got to really work on those chops so that you can be free, so that then you can flow with precision and actually flow with something to say. If somebody wants to just pick up an instrument and say, I don't need any scales. I don't need to know. I'm just going to express myself. Yeah, you can express yourself, but it's going to be really limited. And maybe you'll interest yourself, but you're probably not going to get anybody else jumping up and down. Real spontaneity that has substance requires a lot of discipline. And I think that's a thing that in any innovative endeavor, it's important for people to recognize that there's a discipline to be balanced that leads to the spontaneity. If you have a personality that needs expressing.
Yeah. So do you feel that spontaneity is part of innovation?
I think that's where innovation, that's almost, you could say what innovation is, where you suddenly go, Oh, wait a minute. That light bulb thing is where does that come from again? It comes from allowing yourself to not always be thinking within this box. To just let your mind open, and all of a sudden you're going, oh, wow, I could do this with that. That's interesting. Or you make a mistake. And instead of saying, oh, that's a mistake, you go, wait a minute, I like that. And so I think that actually in any creative endeavor, you can't learn to do anything right without making mistakes. So welcome the mistakes. Love the mistakes, learn from the mistakes, look at the mistakes and tell you what are there are teachers. Whether it's martial arts, okay, just got punched in the nose. I think there's something I need to look at here. Okay, that move in that graffiti writers where they have very high standards, the best ones. And I've taken pictures of people's and I said, oh, hey, revoke. I got a picture of that piece over by blah. He goes, oh man, throw that away. It's awful. That piece is awful. So they have high standards. And I think that you have self-criticality balanced with self-trust and openness to something new and boom. Use an innovator.
I love it. Oh my goodness. Well, it was fabulous too, because you answered my last question so eloquently. And so I need to have you back. at some point, because there is so much more of your career to discuss.
Well, I'd be happy to. You.
Oh, would love to have you back, because we didn't not
well, thank even you, Yolanda.
On the film career and working with film, and not as and we touched just a tad on music. It's, oh my goodness, and then the patent. You mentioned the patent, and so.
And we haven't discussed my criminal career at all. Oops,
never mind. Well, we won't.
It's been a pleasure, Yolanda. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. And thank you for sharing your passion. And also the ability for someone to have multiple passions and to really become excellent in so many different areas. Because sometimes in our lives, I feel that we're told you need to specialize and you need to become experts in one area. But you have demonstrated that you can have passion and curiosity and dedication to multiple areas and then just have a dynamic outcome from that. And also blending and thinking about the crossover of those to reach flow in whatever you're doing. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I hope you can edit out my blushing.
Oh, good. Well, nope, we can't.
Thanks again, Yolanda, and we'll talk to you soon.
So we hope today's episode has inspired you to look beyond the surface and seek the stories hidden in urban art, appreciate martial arts, and find joy in the rhythms of swing dance. And then also realize that you can have multiple passions within this life. Steve's journey teaches us that diverse passions not only enriches our lives, but also contributes to the cultural tapestry of our communities. So thank you for tuning in to Innovation Insights podcast, and be sure to subscribe using your favorite platform to catch other stories of innovation by remarkable individuals shaping our world. So, well, this is Yolanda Sanders. I'm signing off. So keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.